Hello and welcome. This week, the Natural Selection presents Deep Seas. Hello, welcome or welcome back. We are the Natural Selection. We were definitely a class, maybe a family, and in no particular order. I'm Naomi, and I'm joined by Nick.
Hello.
And Nick.
Hello.
They're both called Nick, in case you haven't picked up on that. Would one of you care to tell any new listeners who we are?
I could do that. We're the Natural Selection. We're a group of taxonomists who want to bring our passion for nature into the wild. Each week, we gather and wax lyrical about the natural world. In the first section of our delightful podcast, we talk about nature news and interesting research from the past week. And in the second section of our delightful podcast, we talk about a different theme and how it relates to flora and fauna around the world. This week's theme is deep seas.
Have you guys had any interesting nature interactions this week?
Yes. I have one that's inexplicable and one that was just quite pleasant. I watched a heron for a while standing. In Berlin, a lot of people have these inflatable boats where you can sort of float about the canal. And there were lots of people sitting in them in the beautiful sunshine. But in the middle, there was one of those posts that you get in the water. And standing atop, not moving, but stretched very tall, was just the most elegant heron, which was nice. But the other thing, which is really bizarre, is there's been these giant, you know, like dandelion seeds. I don't know if you guys have them in America.
Oh, I know exactly what you're about to say. We do, but it's from a different species. They're cottonwoods in America.
So, yeah. Walking around the city, there's just been like an equivalent of like giant dandelion seeds everywhere. It looks like sort of, yeah, it's all very odd. It looks like almost like Christmassy, because it's just like falling from the sky.
Yeah, some sort of seed puff.
Yeah, and I've no idea what it's from. I assume a tree, because it is everywhere.
Yeah, I don't know what tree it comes from, but I don't know if it's what's causing my hay fever, but my nature interaction of the last week or so has been intense allergies. But I've also seen a lot of bats. Maybe I'm out at a reasonable hour, i.e. like the long twilight of summer is here, or the bats are out now, or they're back, or so I don't know how bats work. We'll have to do an episode on bats sometime to sort that out, but they're nice.
Are you sure it wasn't just a dog crossed with a dinosaur?
It was quite small, so it could have been. I didn't get a good look.
I was going to say as well, I feel like I was going to ask about allergies and stuff, because there's not quite the same thing, but there's a lot of trees around where I work that have really large pieces of pollen, and I keep accidentally inhaling it and then having a coughing fit, and it's very annoying. So that's part of my in-nature interaction as well. Also, again, I've seen a lot of the water birds on my way to work, and all the little babies, and they've gotten so big, actually, which is really cute. The water coots, they've increased considerably in size. They're still small and fluffy, but definitely a little bigger. And I think that's kind of it for what I've seen this week.
What I love about this, Naomi, is I know that you walk through Hyde Park and you mention all of the water birds and all of the little babies, and not once have you mentioned seeing a goose, which I know live there.
Yeah, I've seen geese.
But you just won't even give them radio time.
No, they're fine. They're okay. They keep their distance. I keep mine. It's all good. Oh, I actually did see a lot of crows as well, and it's kind of a suspiciously large amount of crows, and I'm kind of waiting for something to happen so I can have a crow related story to tell you guys, but so far nothing has happened.
Let's hope it's not a murder.
Yeah.
Hey!
So I think with that we should get started with the news. I'm actually going to kick things off this week, and I'm going to talk about a piece of research that was published in Scientific Reports from Nature, and it was completed by researchers from the University of New South Wales. Quite a cool discovery that they found. They found a new population of blue whales. So blue whales, despite their size, they're really difficult to study, particularly in the southern hemisphere. A lot of things about them remain unknown. they're kind of a bit reclusive, and also they tend to be out at deep sea. I saw a funny piece in the article from one of the researchers that said they're not like humpback whales, they're not show ponies, they don't jump about. It's estimated that less than 0.15% of the blue whales in the southern hemisphere survived whaling. So their population took a dramatic toll from whaling. And their populations are in recovery, but because there's less known about them, it's difficult to say. But thankfully, blue whales do have a very iconic song, and it's quite stereotyped, and they repeat it a lot. Also, were able to figure out their populations because they have distinct vocal signatures. So you can use this to monitor different kind of acoustic populations or groups. So until quite recently, there was 4 recognized blue whale populations from 2 subspecies. So the Antarctic blue whale and the pygmy blue whale. But this research, and it was made possible using the data from the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. So basically what this is it's monitoring for potential nuclear bomb tests, and they use this monitoring of ocean sounds for scientific research. So listening to this work, they found this particular strong signal, and it had previously been identified in the recordings, but the scientists didn't really know that much about it. So in this work, they kind of studied it quite closely, looking at the structure, the frequency and tempo. And they realized that it actually belonged to a group of pygmy blue whales and not one that had been previously recorded in the area. So they found this new group of pygmy blue whales. And I was kind of getting a little bit excited, thinking like, cute pygmy blue whales. But just to put it into context, they are not small. So pygmy blue whales are the smallest members of the blue whale kind of family, but they can reach lengths of up to 24 meters long, which is about the length of 2 standard buses.
And what, a normal sized blue whale is 3 buses?
Yeah, I think the normal sized whale can get up to like 26 meters or something. It's not that much smaller. I'm not sure why it got that title. Yes, this is a new population of this subspecies of blue whale.
That's great.
That's good news.
I think you also had some relatively good news as well to share this week, Nick.
I do, and I'll tell you about it in just a moment, but I will say I just looked up a size comparison for the pygmy blue whale and the other blue whales. And there's a human for scale in the picture, and still, the human isn't even as big as half of the mouth of the pygmy whale. So, the pygmy whale. So, pygmy there is an interesting word. Also, I think culturally insensitive. So, we should think about that too.
Isn't it weird how some animals you have, like, why aren't hippos the giant hippo, you know?
Yes, you're exactly right. And why isn't there a panda? There's a red panda and a giant panda. Where's the panda?
I literally went through that when I spoke about red pandas.
Nick, you expect me to remember anything before marsupials? That's my memory cut off. Okay, I'll have to re-listen to that episode. I do have some good news. This is a sort of interesting mix of ecology and genetics work, or rather evolution, ecology, and genetics altogether. So this is a study that was published in also Scientific Reports, and it's basically trying to figure out how to help bees. I always love helping bees, but in this case, they're doing it in an interesting way. So one of the biggest problems for bees is a tiny mite called Varroa destructor. I assume that's how you pronounce it. Who knows? I don't speak Latin. But it's a mite. It's parasitic. It sticks on the back of the bee where they can't get it off, and it spreads diseases that kill bees. The current method of dealing for beekeepers with the parasite is miticides, a type of pesticide. The 2 problems come along with this. It's a pesticide, so it brings along with it the ecosystem-wide issues that other pesticides bring along that we know so well from Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. But also it can harm the bees, no surprise, since it's toxic to animals. So it harms the bees in too large of quantities, can stop them from reproducing, and it can even kill them if the dose is too high. So it's something that beekeepers use reluctantly and with a lot of care. But these researchers are trying to find an alternative. So they were looking at some fungi that target this tiny mite, the Varroa destructor. And they found this fungus, Metarhizum acridum, that targets the mites. And when spores from the fungus land on the mites, the spores grow tubes that pierce through the mite's exoskeleton, spread inside the body, and kill them from the inside out. Pretty dramatic. It works great as a biopesticide, but it turns out that the fungus doesn't grow very well at the temperature inside a bee's hive, which is about 35 degrees Celsius, my ideal temperature, which is, I know, hot for you northern latitude, people from northern latitudes. But so basically they're trying to figure out if there's a way they could help these fungi, this fungus, become more heat resistant. So they put the fungus through a series of generations in the lab, slowly increasing the temperature of the incubation the fungus was at. And a lot of the fungus died along the way. So they kept cultivating the fungus that survived at the higher and higher temperatures. So they got the fungus sort of by unnatural selection, if you will, adjusted and acclimated to be able to live at those higher temperatures. And once they had this heat-resistant strain of the fungus, they brought it into the hive, tried it out on the mites, and found that it only killed about 2% of the mites. They weren't sure why. It seemed that maybe the virulence of the fungus went down as it became more heat resistant, which, I don't know, this wasn't quite well explained in the research that I was reading, or I didn't quite understand it, is rather probably what happened. But they tried the same thing, this unnatural selection, where they took just the ones that killed the mites and reproduced those fungi. So several generations later, the fungus was up to killing about 50% of the mites in the hives that they were testing it on. And so now they can use this as a biopesticide, and it is about as effective as the general pesticides that are used. It's a little more expensive, but it has fewer of these repercussions. It's a cool way of making, I don't know, using natural ecological interactions to help the bees out.
That's really cool. I also, it's much better than pesticides.
Yeah, it does make me a little bit worried that the fungus, I feel like if it really needed to be in that hive, it would probably have done that itself. But, you know, playing God, it's genetics. That's what they do.
Yeah, I suppose there is that worry when they're kind of manipulating a scenario, right? But, you know.
Yeah. I mean, what happens when the hyper heat resistant, super virulent strain of fungus is released in the world? And, like, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, it's not going to do anything except to the mites, hopefully. So.
Hopefully. So, Nick, you have some cool news this week in more ways than one.
Yeah, so my news, pretty short but sweet. It's about Deloid rotifers. So they were some scientists. They were mucking about in the Arctic, as scientists are wont to do. And in the permafrost, they found a 24,000-year-old Deloid rotifer that was still alive and that it was brought back to life. And this is quite interesting. So this isn't the oldest animal that they found, but this is a multicellular animal that is 24,000 years old. And they did this using radiocarbon dating, and they slowly thawed it, and they found it was alive, and they're able to sort of, yeah, grow it and clone it. So sort of an amazing survival story, and generally just a good way to highlight Deloid rotifers. They're an animal most people haven't heard of. They're quite interesting. They are, you know how, like, evolutionary asexuality is often a dead end, that eventually it will just lead to the death of a species because there's not enough variants. These guys are the weirdos that don't die. They've been asexual for about 25 million years. And with survival tactics like this, you can see why.
Good on them.
Yeah. Yeah, they're plowing along. They don't need nobody. Also, reading up on rotifers, I didn't know this. I read this on Wikipedia, I must confess. But it just said, most species of rotifers are cosmopolitan species. Which doesn't mean that they sort of, yeah, live in the trendy part of London. It means they live in pretty much all over the world. So it's the opposite of endemic. Which, yeah, saying most rotifers. But this is specifically a Bedelloid rotifer, because rotifers do sexual reproduction, but Bedelloid rotifers don't.
That's really interesting. I like that.
Thanks.
I feel like those are the kind of animals, they're maybe not quite as cool and funky as tardigrades, but they still do some pretty impressive things.
I think it's because they're called Deloid, and that's almost impossible to say.
that could be it, yeah. So that does bring us to the end of our news section this week. Please do join us after this short break when we will be back with our theme, which this week is deep seas. Welcome back. So this brings us to the part of the episode where we talk about our theme. And this week we're talking all about deep seas. And I think we're going to kick things off with a quiz this week. So Nick, would you like to take it away? Pew,
pew, pew. Quiz time. Yeah, definitely. I've never done a quiz on the podcast before, so I'm excited. I had some fun making this one for you guys. Our theme is deep seas, and we've all seen Blue Planet 2, the deep sea episode, and how crazy everything is down there. But Naomi and Nick will do the real science, give you the real deal stuff today. But I wanted to take you through some of the fun, you know, we talk about nomenclature in this podcast often. So I pulled together some of the craziest names of deep sea creatures and made up a few of my own. And I want to see if you guys can guess which ones are real and which ones are fake. You ready?
Yes.
Great. Let's start with the whiplash squid. Real or fake?
Real.
I'm going to say fake.
The whiplash squid is real.
I think I know what it is.
Go on.
Isn't it that one that has, like, again, I often say this about animals, but it looks like Tim Burton designed it. It's got, like, the longest dangly legs.
Yeah, exactly. There are a few different kinds. It's a family, in fact. But they're usually the ones that are super bright red on camera, and they sort of hang in the water column with their legs dangling down below them. Pretty cool looking. Weird, freaky. Ready for next one? Skeleton crab.
I'm going to go fake again.
Yeah, fake.
I made that one up. Yeah, good call, guys. Okay, good. Dragonfish.
Real.
Real?
Real. Here's an easy one. Goblin shark.
Real.
Real.
Real. And super cool looking. The goblin shark is one of my deep sea faves.
Its mouth jumps out.
Exactly. Yeah, it has the extended... Yeah, many of the jawed fishes have that extendable, the protruding jaw, but theirs is particularly nasty. All right, next one, zombie worms.
Real.
I'm going to go fake.
The zombie worms are real, and they feed particularly and especially on bones of fallen whales, which is why they get that name. You see them sticking out of the carcass like fur.
Ooh.
We're moving on. The next one is xenomorph.
False.
True?
I didn't make it up, but it's a sci-fi creature from the Alien franchise.
Oh, yeah.
Well, can I just tell you there, Nick? It's not it, it's she.
Oh, sorry. I actually read about it a lot last night in preparation for this episode, and I found that there's many different clades or castes of in the xenomorph family tree, many different life cycles. So, there's a queen, in fact. I didn't know that they were social, but they are. The queen is enormous. Okay, but enough about xenomorphs. Ready for our next one? The terrible claw lobster.
Real.
I'm going to go fake again.
Real again.
He's doing so much better than me this one.
I couldn't tell you.
I haven't got one wrong yet.
You haven't, Nick. You're doing quite well. The terrible claw lobster is real, and I wouldn't want to meet one. All right, here's a fun one.
You know what? I've never heard of it, but it was just, it's not a name that you would make up. Like, it's way too straight-laced for you to make that up.
I just looked it up, and basically it's a normal lobster, except one of its claws is enormous. But not like enormous, but like extended, like something you'd see in the movie Saw, like a torture weapon.
Oh god, yeah. It's like it's got it's doing an impression of a crocodile. With its hand.
Exactly. With its, with crocodile mouth and its claw. Conveniently, it's in the family, or in the genus Dinochelys, which means terrible claw. We have Stargazer, real or fake?
Fake.
Fake.
Real.
Oh, I got one wrong.
Frankenstein fish.
Real.
Real.
Fake, made it up. The black swallower.
Real.
I don't think you'd make that up. Real.
It's real. It can swallow things 10 times its weight. And then we'll just wrap up with the last two. We have the sarcastic fringe head.
Fake.
Real.
That one's real. And finally, Star Eater.
Fake.
Real.
Real again! Really, this was astounding to me in that all of these crazy things sound like sci-fi monsters. So I hope that you take some time to look up some of these creatures because they look even cooler than they sound.
Wow, thank you. That was so informative. I feel like both informative and also non-informative because those names are crazy. But I like it. I like it. Yeah, there's some wild and crazy things in the deep sea. And some of the reasons they're wild and crazy is because the deep sea is a pretty tough environment. So I was going to maybe talk through with you guys some of the things that maybe you can think of as to why the deep sea is so difficult to live in. Firstly, I'd like to just briefly talk about some of the zones of the sea, because there's different levels and there's different things that live at different levels. I'll just quickly go through some of them. So there's epipelagic, mesopelagic, bathypelagic, abyssopelagic, and hadopelagic. So the pelagic zone is kind of the top zone, and it goes from the surface down to about 200 meters. So it's got lots of life, lots of photosynthesis, so there's lots of nutrients in that environment. The mesopelagic zone, which is also known as the twilight zone, goes from about 200 meters to about 1,000 meters. And that's where you're not really getting enough light for photosynthesis to occur. And the ones below that are fully dark. So the bathypelagic zone is from about 1,000 to 4,000 meters. And you're getting a lot of bioluminescent animals in this kind of area. And then in the abyssopelagic zone is from about 4,000 directly to the ocean floor. The final zone is the hadopelagic zone, and its name comes from the Greek Hades. And it's the ocean water in submarine trenches. So what kind of things do you think of when you think of deep sea, and what kind of characteristics might you find in areas kind of below that photosynthetic area, like where you're not getting photosynthesis anymore? Can you think of any challenges?
Where do you get energy?
Yeah, that's certainly a massive one, yeah.
Probably a bit chilly.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely cold, low nutrients. So finding food is difficult. So one, when they find food, they want to be able to eat anything. So as Nick mentioned, a lot of them have really large mouths. They have expandable jaws. They have stomachs that can consume prey way larger than them. So that once they do come across prey, they can eat it. They often have like large, stabby teeth. And another thing is they sometimes want to attract prey to them as well. So they'll have lures, bioluminescent lures, so say something like the angular fish. Also something they can use to attract mates as well, because it's hard to find other fish of the same species when everything's dark and spread out in the deep sea. Another thing that I'm not sure you guys mentioned, but the pressure is also pretty strong down in the deep ocean. So,
well, I think the pressure to find a mate is hard up here, so.
That's true, yeah. So the pressure means that, like, a lot of animals kind of below the mesopelagic, kind of below those zones, they would have very kind of watery muscles, is how I read it. So basically the pressure doesn't get them because they have so much water in their body. They tend to be kind of weak animals, tend to be relatively small, although that's not always the case, as we may find out later. And another thing that they often have is bioluminescence, which I will talk a little bit about later. But there's some pretty cool things, like Nick said, definitely worth Googling some animals and some of the freaky jaws and body shapes they have. But it's a pretty tricky place to live in, and I think it's a pretty difficult place to study as well. So we're learning new things about the deep seas all the time as well. So as I mentioned, one of the characteristics is that these deep sea fish and other animals can sometimes be small, but sometimes that's not always the case. Nick, I think you're going to tell us about some examples of things that don't do that.
Yes. I wanted to talk about deep sea giganticism. So you touched on the difficulties of sort of living in the deep sea. Sort of famous for its pressure, as you mentioned, which you'd think would encourage smaller animals if there's such like force acting down upon them. Example, I found one thing right now. I couldn't find an actual reference for this, but someone alluded to the fact that a football could be compressed to the size of a marble in the deep ocean depths. So there's exceptional pressure acting on these animals, which you'd think would make them small. But actually, it's not so much, because, yeah, they can build tissues which just survive in this environment. So why might they suddenly become gigantic? Well, there's a few reasons for this. Large animals are more efficient, which might seem wrong in your head. You think, like, well, a smaller animal can eat less food. But actually, if you think when you're swimming, which do you think is a more efficient swimmer, a blue whale or a tiny little fish? Obviously, the blue whale is able to, yeah, swim much more efficiently to go long distances. And in an environment where crossing long distance might be important to either get food or find a mate, this efficiency can be really, really important. But also, they have slower metabolisms. So they have a smaller surface-to-body ratio, which, yeah, in the deep-sea cold environment can be really, really important. Also, cold water dissolves more oxygen, which means that this can support larger bodies. If there's more oxygen, there's more fuel for them, so they're able to grow larger tissues. But basically, what it is it's almost a very specialized type of island giganticism. So you're probably familiar with that. We've talked about it before, how species on islands can become very, very large. And this is because islands have limited resources, there's limited predators, and they're isolated from the rest of sort of life. Now, if you think of the deep sea, it has limited resources, it has limited predators, and it's isolated from the rest of the ocean. So essentially, it's acting as an island. So this could be seen as sort of like a specialized type of island giganticism. The other thing is that larger bodies can actually survive longer without food. So while they might need more food in the long run, they can survive longer without eating, which if you have to travel large distances to find food, this can be really, really good. So you travel a long way, but you have to find more food when you get there, rather than short distances to find a little bit. So the extreme example of that would be a hummingbird, which has to eat a little really often. What they can do is if they're big, they can travel a long distance and eat a lot. But there's some really cool examples of deep sea giganticism, including, I often rail against badly named things, but I think this is a brilliantly named thing, the big red jellyfish. Yeah, often things are red down there. You don't often find blue animals because, yeah, basically, I believe that makes them invisible because red light is the one thing that doesn't reflect. So, yeah, things are often red. Another one is the giant isopod, which is often tagged as nightmare fuel, which to me is it's basically a type of woodlouse. Nick, I think you call them something else. I can't remember what Americans call them.
Isopods. No, that was going to be on my list, but I cut it for time.
Do you call them roly-polies or like cheese bugs or something?
Oh, the little ones, yeah. Mm-hmm. Not the big ones.
Yeah.
Pillbugs? Is that another name for them too?
Yeah.
Yeah, we call them roly-polies or, yeah, woodlice.
Oh, okay. Oh, you do call them woodlice. Cool. Giant sea spider, which isn't a spider, but if you look at that, it's, again, very, very creepy. Very long legs. The Japanese spider crab, which you might recognise, is an enormous crab. And this is very true, this deep-sea giganticism, especially for crabs. But perhaps the most famous ones, actually I should mention, the oarfish is a really good example, another very famous one, very long, thin fish. That's a deep-sea fish, and this is an example of deep-sea giganticism. But perhaps the most famous sort of group of animals which get big the deeper you go. Any guesses, guys?
Squid.
Yes. Squid. There are loads of squid that have got really, really big. And most of the biggest squid live really, really deep. And that's ignoring the colossal squid, the largest one, which is 14 meters, and the giant squid, the next biggest, which is 12 meters. Even the next few largest squid are all deep sea squid. So Onychia robusta, Tanangia danae, Galitoithis phylura. Like the list goes on of all these squid that live deep down and have got to these enormous sizes. So why does this happen? What's interesting is one study found that it's actually probably linked to temperature more than anything, because they found that when there was a temperature differentiation, this is when giganticism occurred. When there wasn't a real big difference between the deep sea temperature and the shallow sea temperature, they found that the species weren't getting bigger. So it appeared after all these effects, the most strong one is the temperature. And that they are reacting to a temperature that is getting colder, so they are getting bigger. Not all of them. There is also, like island dwarfism, there is an equivalent of things with this, where some get smaller as well. Myofauna taxa, I've never really heard of them, but the myofauna taxa actually gets smaller, and this is well known in the community, where they actually have to use the smaller nets to catch them when they're in the deep sea. So, yeah. That was my little talk on deep sea giganticism.
Big words.
Cool. Oh, I was going to say something like that.
Big if true.
Cool. That was very informative. Thank you. Big talk. No, it just sounds like I'm being mildly passive aggressive when I say big in front of something. Anyway. The deep sea is a tricky place to study, but there are some people that are doing some pretty cool research and helping us see and understand the deep sea. I think, Nick, you're going to tell us a little bit about some of that.
Yeah. Listening to what Nick just mentioned, you know, I am just dying to see some of these things. And, well, that's what I'm here to tell you guys about. So I took a step away from the science this week to do a little bit of research. I wanted to share one of my favorite things about the deep sea research going on today in the world of marine biology. And it's an exploration vessel called the Nautilus that does research on the deep sea, and it's owned by the nonprofit Ocean Exploration Trust. And basically, they go out into deep sea areas and send down remote operated vehicles, these ROVs, that can travel down to a depth of around 4,000 meters, so into the abyssal zone, but not down into the trenches. So in that sort of all no light zone that we don't really know much about, that Nick was just telling us about, the place where it's hard to live. And I think the gem of this research program, and the reason that I'm talking about it today, is their live stream. When they have active research programs going, they broadcast 24/7 from the ship vessel. And they talk about things like living on a research ship and taking field notes and this sort of thing. But when they send down the ROVs, the live stream is part of their broadcast. So that's where the juicy bits come in. And you get to see some of the stuff that they're discovering as they're discovering it down in the bottom of the sea, which I think is it's really exciting to see that sort of science live. So they will even do these question and answer sessions with the researchers who are running the ROVs at the same time. And it's cool. When you watch these videos, they have a YouTube channel, which I'll describe. I'll send you to at the end of this little section. But when you watch the videos, you can hear all the different researchers sort of talking about what they're seeing. And they don't sound like scientists. They sound like kids a lot of the time. They're like, what is that? It's so cool. Oh, my God. but it's not, I mean, it's really, it humanizes the work that they're doing in a really cool way. I mean, these are brilliant marine biologists, and they're doing some really cool work, and it's fun to see them having fun. But they have a whole list of best highlights and sort of the best of the season that you can see in videos on their YouTube channel, which is EV Nautilus on YouTube. You can also see their live streams on nautiluslive.org. I got a little bit sidetracked, I have to admit, while I was doing the research for this week, and I watched a bunch of the videos, some of them I hadn't seen before, and there's some super cool stuff. It's not just like, and here's a crab, here's a this. They have some videos where a sperm whale came by and sort of circled around their research vessels for a while. They see vampires, squids, and Dumbo octopus, and some really cool, crazy jellyfish with beautiful colors, and they've all got it in high definition as they're sort of seeing it live. My favorite one, though, is where they find this sort of perfect, translucent purple orb. Looks like a crystal ball, and no one knows what it is. They're like, they're trying to figure it out, and they guess all these different things, and they're explaining themselves and giving their reasoning. And in the end, what they do is they suck it into a tube for a later investigation. Turns out it was a snail egg. It's really fun to sort of see this mystery science of this part of our world that we don't know so well being discovered live. It's awesome. So check it out if you have time.
Wow, so cool. Yeah, I just took a sneaky peek at one of their videos, and one of the ones, the whale carcass. Wow.
Oh, yeah.
So cool. I think also it's nice as well, the way you're describing it, it's really nice to kind of see scientists as they're discovering something and kind of that they don't even know what it is. I think it's so, like you said, kind of humanizing, and it makes it very relatable because you're really showing you how undiscovered and how unknown this area is, because even the people who are like literally studying it right there don't know things. It's cool.
Yeah. And it's a bit like a lottery game. Like, they don't know that they're going to see cool stuff down there, and they hope that they do, but they're sort of doing other work. And when something cool comes into camera, then they get excited about it, which is fun.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Cause I guess it's not very densely populated the deep ocean. But something we talked about is kind of the lack of nutrients that you get in the deep sea. Definitely a big problem because there's no photosynthetic organisms. But there are some ways of getting nutrients. There's some things that do manage to fall down into the deep ocean. Am I right, Nick?
You are right. So I wanted to talk about where a lot of this energy comes from, which is marine snow, which is a beautiful name for something which looks quite creepy. If you watch the videos that Nick's talking about, you'll notice that nearly all of them are populated with this sort of drifting snow-like material in the background. And it's ever present. You'll see it just sort of floating down gently. And what it is organic matter. It's usually about 0.5 millimeter to a few centimeters across. And generally, it's the remains of plankton, sort of free-flowing things that exist in the shallower seas. But it can also include fecal matter and carcasses. So it's not all pleasant. And as they descend, what happens is they clump together. So as they touch each other, they tend to stick together. So they get larger and larger and larger. And this is what gives the appearance of snow. You sort of get these beautiful snowflakes. But to me, it kind of looks like the upside down from Stranger Things. It's sort of otherworldly. It's quite amazing. And it really highlights how underwater you are just because of the slowness of their movement. Like it makes it look like you're not in air and really shows it as an alien environment. Now, the larger the snow, obviously, the quicker it falls. But for snow to reach the ocean floor from the top of the sea, it can still take weeks. So it is a very, very long process. And some animals even try and catch it as it comes down. So I think there's one mollusk, I believe it's a mollusk, which builds this sort of mucus sort of parachute, which catches sea snow that it can eat. Which is, yeah, gross.
Gross.
Yeah. The reason this is important, because this is where the food comes from. Because there's no light down there. So the only way that there can be food produced is deep sea vents, which are actually quite rare. But I'm sure we've all heard of this, where there's no photosynthesis, there's chemosynthesis, where they use the chemicals around the deep sea vents to produce their own energy, these bacteria, which then start their own ecosystem. They're super rare, so you can't really sustain these sort of deep sea environments from them alone. So they are getting their energy from the sun, but it's just taking a long time to drift down there. And what it does do is it creates a really, really nutrient-rich sea floor. So there is lots of animals that can sort of survive on the sea floor that way. The other thing that's really cool is... How am I going to talk about that? Right, I forgot to press play. It works as a carbon lock. So this is really, really important for us. So the ocean absorbs up to 1/4 of the excess carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere. It's obviously really, really important. If it wasn't doing that, we'd be even bigger trouble. But this causes the sea to become more acidic because it's carbon and this makes the sea acidic. And this can affect plankton formation. And as I mentioned before, things like mollusks can be affected because mollusk larvae might struggle to create shells in acidic environments. And this prompted what was allegedly quite an illegal experiment of iron fertilization. This was off the coast of Canada. It was about 8 years ago. Did you guys remember this?
I feel like I remember you bringing it up before, but I don't think I remember it specifically at the time.
So basically, a lot of the photosynthesis is done by algal blooms in the ocean. We tend to think of it as things like the Amazon rainforest, but obviously there's a lot more ocean, and these blooms absorb a lot of carbon dioxide. And there's one virus which can cause them to go into overdrive and absorb even more and then die, and they sink to the bottom of the ocean, taking that carbon with them, which can be really, really useful for us. Now, what this guy did is something called iron fertilization, where essentially he fertilized these algae. So when they died, they took a lot of the carbon with them as a way to sort of do carbon offsetting for businesses. But it was allegedly quite an illegal thing to do, and a lot of people objected at the time. I'm not entirely sure how the legal case went forward. We don't really have very good lawyers on our podcast, so that's why I'm saying allegedly. But a lot of people accused him at the time of breaking the law. Now, the problem with this might seem like a really good idea of sort of, yeah, well, why not lock up that carbon and take it down? But yeah, like I mentioned, this could worsen ocean acidification and global warming in itself and cause huge problems in the ecosystems of the deep sea, which is what we're talking about. Yeah, human experiments into ecosystems have not always gone swimmingly. So this one was quite a bold one on an environment we don't really understand. To read a quote, some possible effects such as deep water oxygen depletion and alteration of distant food webs should rule out ocean manipulation. History is full of examples of ecological manipulations that backfired. So perhaps don't mess with marine snow. Marine snow's best.
Thanks, Nick. Legal advice from the Natural Selection. The Natural Selection presents legal advice.
That was really cool. That was actually something I really wasn't very aware of. I did in a way know that eventually the debris will get to the bottom of the ocean, but I didn't know it was called marine snow. That's fun. Sad about that experiment. It definitely seems like meddling that way could be potentially very problematic. But the final topic I wanted to talk about today, to end on, I wanted to talk about bioluminescence. Something I've definitely mentioned a lot on this show. It's so fun. And it's very prevalent in the deep sea, so I thought might as well bring it up now as well. And something I didn't realize is a study in Nature measured that there's 76% of ocean animals with bioluminescence. It's pretty impressive. So this means that they, yeah, it's a lot.
That's like the majority.
Yeah, I know. And so it means they either produce their own light or through a series of chemical reactions, or they have host bacteria that do. So at least 1,500 species of fish are known to be bioluminescent, so including sharks and dragonfish, one of the animals that was real that Nick mentioned earlier. And, you know, scientists are often finding new ones. So a very iconic one, talked about it earlier, is the anglerfish. The large female anglerfish, she sports a lure, and this piece of glowing bait lures in prey. And bioluminescence is very important in these dark environments. One, it can act to lure in prey. Another thing that it can do is kind of act as camouflage in a way. It breaks up their silhouette. So animals such as the lanternfish, they have it on their sides and bellies. And the bristlemouth also has it, and it breaks up the silhouette, so it makes it harder to see from below, and it helps protect them from predators. And also, the light organ helps them to recognize mates, and each species of lanternfish actually has a different, distinct pattern of lights. Another animal, the Hawaiian bobtail squid, has bioluminescent bacteria that live in their organs, and they use kind of light camouflage, and it camouflages them kind of against the moonlight on the surface. So the way I saw it explained was that it kind of acts as like an invisibility cloak. Basically, the bacteria hide their silhouette because they're able to match the amount of light that's hitting the top of the mantle. So it makes them kind of invisible in the moonlight when viewed from below. And then the squid gives the bacteria food. So bioluminescence is pretty common in squid. It's estimated about that about two-thirds of all squid are bioluminescent. They have light organs or photophores, and they can be found almost all over the body of a squid. But the most common places are the eyes, the mantle, the head and arms. Also inside the internal organs too. That particular species of squid, the Hawaiian bobtail squid, they actually get rid of about 90% of their bacteria in the morning. They like dispel it back into the seawater, and then it replenishes during the day, and then at night they have their new bacteria ready, and they're ready to go up and be camouflaged in the moonlight. The world's smallest shark, the 6-inch lantern shark, it has some photophores, and it's advertising a particular part of its body. Do you guys have any guesses what part of its body it's advertising?
It's sexy fins.
I was going to say it's a lantern.
It's advertising its reproductive organs. So they strut their stuff, and the species has kind of a specific light pattern, and it gives them it tells their mate, you know, that they are of that species as well. Another cool thing that I kind of just discovered was that there's not really any freshwater bioluminescence. And one of the explanations I found for it was simply that few bioluminescent fish can tolerate low salinity. That feels like not quite fully an answer to me. It doesn't really seem like it answers why it's not a thing, that surely it was capable of evolving in seawater, it could evolve in freshwater, but perhaps it's not needed in the same way. But the only instance of bioluminescence in freshwater animals is in Lightia neratodes, which is a limpet-like snail that's native to New Zealand streams, and it emits a glowing slime when bothered. And finally, dinoflagellates. They are something that makes up a lot of plankton, and they have a naturally occurring molecule, similar to the chemical that fireflies have, that's called luciferin, which is named for Lucifer. And they often glow, particularly when disturbed by fish and things, so you often get pretty displays when there's balloons and things. So yeah, that brings me to my end of my bioluminescent session.
I feel illuminated. Sorry, Nick.
You can always trust Naomi to look at the light side of the issues.
Okay.
So I think with that does bring us to an end of this week's episode. Thank you for joining us this week, and thank you guys for sharing your research with me and the listeners this week. We will be back next week, where we'll be talking about bones. I wanted to have a pun, but I couldn't think of one.
I don't know, as long as you make it humorous. Maybe you'll think of one tomorrow.
So from all of us here at The Natural Selection, goodbye.
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 So I think that brings us to the end of our interactions. So with that, we should get on with the news.
No more interactions.
We're done. No, sorry. So I think
place with a robot. We will cease interaction now and commence with news.